Dr. Hoffman here. This Intelligent Medicine podcast is brought to you by Super Beets. I personally take Super Beets when I need a power boost. It's my favorite product. Super Beets gives me energy and stamina for my busy day. Right now, get a one-month supply free with your first order. Check out the Dr. Hoffman special right now at IntelligentBeets.com. That's IntelligentBeets.com. Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. I think we have something very special indeed for you because we have a very influential guest, a person who's reshaping our attitudes towards diet. He's really getting the word out in an important way. He's author of a popular series of books called Wheat Belly. He's none other than Dr. William Davis. He is all over the media. You've seen him on Dr. Oz and on CBS Morning Show and a wide variety of media appearances. And he's written several books, including the original Wheat Belly, which was a number one bestseller. Now he's got a sequel to his original books called The Wheat Belly Total Health. And in that book, he elaborates further on the theory of the deleterious effect of grains. Dr. Davis is a cardiologist, but these days he specializes in communicating information about diet and optimizing health. And so without further ado, here's our guest, Dr. William Davis. Dr. Davis, a pleasure having you on Intelligent Medicine.
Oh, glad to be here, Dr. Hoffman.
Well, great. Wheat belly, what a great way to telegraph that message to the public, because the slogan suggests, it's very evocative, it suggests that wheat is the culprit when it comes to America's epidemic of obesity. And then, throughout your communications, and I've followed you for the past few years, you show example after example of people who have eschewed wheat and, in fact, grains, and they've had dramatic changes in their weight and health. You have the before and after pictures. And why should that be so? What got you on this kick about wheat? I mean, wheat is merely emblematic, I think, of the whole family of grains, correct?
Yeah, exactly. So wheat is nothing more than the seed of a grass. That, of course, is literally true. We don't eat the entire plant, of course. We don't eat the stalk or the leaves, the roots, or the husk. We can try and isolate the seed, dry it, pulverize it, and do what we want with it, make turn it into bread or beer or porridge. But it remains the seed of the grass. And grasses are unusually promiscuous. They mate with each other. And so it means that the genetic features of wheat are shared to a substantial degree with rye, barley, even corn and oats, millet, and all those other seeds of grasses. So there's tremendous overlap. The reason I got started on this, practicing cardiology, was I was trying to find better answers. As you know, in conventional healthcare, the standard approach to coronary disease, that is, heart attacks and sudden cardiac death and all that kind of nasty business, is to simply put people in the cath lab, and if there's any mention of prevention, it's prescribe a statin drug and a low-fat diet and some exercise.
Right, that's the sum total of it, yeah.
Exactly. And you and I know it doesn't work. It may impact to some degree on risk, but it's by no means a guarantee that you won't have an event. And, you know, I watched disease progress. I saw it in front of my eyes get worse, 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 year after year. Well, there's a basic principle I'm sure you're familiar with, and that is, you can't have a high blood sugar and have control over your heart health. You can't be diabetic. You cannot be pre-diabetic. You can't even have blood sugars a little above normal because they're associated with increased cardiovascular risk. So I wanted to address that aspect of patients' risks better. I didn't want to do it with insulin. I didn't want to do it with oral diabetes drugs. I wanted to do it naturally, preferably with diet. So I asked, well, what food dominates breakfast, lunch, dinner, and raises blood sugar to a high level, a high glycemic index? Well, the obvious answer is not millet or teff, right? It's wheat. Wheat as toast and pancakes and waffles and breakfast cereals, and as lunch as sandwiches, and dinner as pasta, etc. So I asked patients to remove this exceptional high glycemic index food that dominated diet. And people did it, and they'd come back 3 months later, or at least a few months later, and they'd say, well, yeah, my blood sugars did come down. In fact, if I was on insulin, I'd have to reduce the dose, maybe even got off insulin, had to reduce oral blood sugar medicines. But it was all the other things that people started to tell me that I blundered and stumbled into. And that is, people would say things like, but why did my asthma go away and I don't need my inhalers anymore? Why did my depression lift? Why did this chronic skin rash I had for 9 years disappear within a week? Why did my acid reflux go away within a week? Why did my bowel urgency of my irritable bowel syndrome disappear? Why is my ulcerative colitis so much better that I could stop two drugs? And it was this outpouring of story after story, things I never anticipated. And that's why I asked, what could have happened? What is different about wheat that allows this extravagant effect, this food that we're all urged to consume more of?
Right, it's considered the staff of life, you know, literally the fundamental, the base of the nutritional pyramid is whole grains embodied by, you know, whole wheat bagels and pancakes, whole wheat cereals. You know, we go to the cereal aisle, and now you can see whole wheat Count Chocula cereal for kids. It's got whole wheat in it, which is beneficial and high fiber, and isn't that good?
Well, it became apparent when you talk to agricultural scientists, they tell you readily that, well, wheat's not the same today as it was in, say, 1960. It was changed through extensive genetics experiments. This, by the way, Dr. Hoffman, all predates the methods of genetic modification. And I'm very careful about that because the defenders of the wheat industry, the grain industry, say, Davis is wrong. There is no such thing as genetically modified wheat.
Well, in fact, true, because there's genetically modified corn, there's genetically modified, what they make canola from, rapeseed, and, you know, just a few species. But wheat, they so far have not genetically, they haven't GMO'd it yet. It's just
exactly.
highly bred. There's a technology that's involved in more conventional crossbreeding and hybridization.
Well, it's a game they play. Just as the tobacco industry was very good at this, the grain industry is also very good at this. What they didn't tell us, or don't tell you, is that while wheat has not been genetically modified, meaning no gene splicing was used to insert a gene, it was changed using other methods. As you point out, repetitive hybridization, mating wheat with other grasses, and the methods of mutagenesis, that is, the purposeful induction of mutations using toxic chemicals, gamma rays, and high-dose X-ray. What they don't tell you is, that's right, wheat has not been changed using the methods of genetic modification. In many instances, the methods used to change wheat were worse than genetic modification. The GM technologies introduce a handful of mutations or changes. The methods of mutagenesis introduce hundreds of changes. Yet those products have been on store shelves for over 30 years. And so what we're being sold today as wheat is the product of a high-yield semi-dwarf collection of strains. It stands 18 inches tall. It's not the 4.5 or 5 foot tall stuff we all remember. It's a very different plant. Looks different. It's biochemically different. It's genetically different. And its effects on humans who try to consume the seeds of this plant, very, very different.
So this may actually account for the fact that ancient cultures may have subsisted on grains without such deleterious effects. So we say, oh, well, look at the ancient Egyptians. Although, you know, it's been demonstrated that they had obesity, they had diabetes, they had atherosclerosis, it's actually been thought that the move from hunter-gatherer to a Neolithic agriculture with grains, there was a, you know, change in the health of people, that they were shorter stature, they did develop more degenerative diseases, that even that produced some adverse effects.
That's exactly right. You know what impresses me is that anthropologists have known this for decades. They've known for a long time that when, as you point out, the pre-agricultural hunter-gatherer humans, when we first, in desperation, by the way, turned to the seeds of grasses, whether it was einkorn wheat in the Fertile Crescent or millet and sorghum in sub-Saharan Africa or teosinte, the forerunner of corn in Central America or rice in the swamps of Southeast Asia. When humans turned to those seeds of grasses, you're exactly right. There was a change in, there was a drop in height. There was an explosion in tooth decay. Tooth decay, interestingly, I'm surprised that dentists aren't more aware of this. Prior to the consumption of seeds of grasses, tooth decay was almost unknown. During a time when there was no dental floss, toothbrushes, toothpaste, fluoridated water, dentists or orthodontists, and almost no tooth decay. Now we have, of course, with the introduction of grains, explosive tooth decay. Tooth
right.
decay is the rule.
Well, you know, I think it was Dr. Weston Price, who I'm sure you're very familiar with, who first documented this phenomenon. He went around the world, I believe, in the 1930s and looked at cultures that were pre-agricultural, and then he looked at their counterparts who were urbanized and introduced to a Western diet, and he documented with very vivid photographs the degenerative changes in their mouths and gums and teeth with these dietary alterations more towards a Western diet.
Priceless observations, very graphic, as you recall, there's tooth loss, tooth abscess, deformities, crooked teeth. It's an astounding, just from the teeth and oral flora perspective, the consumption of grains was a disaster for humans, even with the traditional or ancient grains prior to any human-introduced changes. So I think what agribusiness did in the 70s, when they created this, essentially a wheat that came out of a laboratory, is they exaggerated the problems in this plant. They made them much worse. In some ways, I'm grateful, because had they not done this, we might not have noticed so easily that wheat was the most destructive food ever created. But it became so obvious that now as we look back, we wonder why there's been an explosion in diabetes, and both type 1 and type 2, by the way, and obesity, and autoimmune diseases, and dysbiosis. We look and it's becoming clearer and clearer. A lot of it, not all of it, of course, but a lot of it can be blamed on this creation of agribusiness and genetics research called high-yield semi-dwarf wheat.
Now, some of your critics, people who push back against your theories, say, okay, look, you know, there are some people who have celiac disease. We're recognizing this as a problem. Perhaps it occurs in 1 in 200 individuals. Maybe it's even more common than that in certain populations, perhaps 1 in 100 or 1 in 80. But the other 79 out of 80 people are fine as long as they don't have celiac disease. They won't come to harm because they don't have this specific autoimmune severe intolerance to wheat and gluten products. So what would be your reaction to their effort to try and limit this to a very, very small percentage of the population?
You know, that's the defense being used by the grain industry and the people they pay, both PR agencies and physicians and nutrition scientists. What they're not telling us is that, let's put aside celiac disease for a moment. You're right. 1% or less of Americans who have this intestinal destruction from the gluten protein. What about the activation of autoimmune disease that occurs in the majority of people? If we believe Dr. Fasano's data from University of Maryland, the meticulous explorations of how autoimmune diseases get started, like rheumatoid arthritis, it's started by the gliadin protein. It initiates the first step in autoimmunity. How about the gliadin protein that, upon partial digestion, remember, it's a seed of a grass, and so components of seeds are very poorly digested. It can be digested to small pieces, not amino acids like other proteins, but small pieces, peptides. And these peptides have a unique structure that allows them to act as opiates on the human brain in non-celiac as well as celiac people, and it causes peculiar opioid effects. It could be appetite stimulation. It could be behavioral outbursts in kids with ADHD. It could be paranoia in people with schizophrenia. It could be food obsessions in people with binge eating disorder and bulimia. We have wheat germ agglutinin, this lectin protein that's highly toxic to the intestinal lining, and it blocks the process of digestion because it blocks cholecystokinin, the hormone of pancreatic and gallbladder function.
And these morphine-like substances have a constipating effect. And certainly if you go into, you know, your average pharmacy, you see row upon row of medications that address America's most prevalent gastrointestinal problem, constipation.
Exactly right. I'm very impressed you knew that. That's pretty obscure stuff.
Well, these are, gliadomorphines are, as you obviously know, morphine-like substances that create almost an addictive response to the wheat. But also, morphine, we know that when we give painkillers to patients who have severe pain problems, they become terribly constipated. We get that effect to some extent with wheat.
It's astounding that we've created an effect, not you and I, of course, but the USDA and agencies that endorse this notion of allowing your diet to be dominated by wheat. We've created a nation, now a world, of opiate addicts. And, you know, when you stop eating it, you go through an opiate withdrawal syndrome. It lasts about a week, and it's very unpleasant.
Well, you described that because I spoke to Jimmy Moore, who's, Living La Vida Low Carb, who's also a low-carbohydrate advocate. And he refers to, let's see, he coined a term, which is... for the withdrawal. I forget the term. It'll come back to me in a moment. But the people actually go through, they sort of jones, like they're going off, withdrawing from heroin when they stop wheat. And it makes it very hard for us clinicians because, you know, our patients are calling us up urgently saying, I feel terrible. You know, what's happening to me? I don't understand. And we have to kind of nurse them through that process.
Yeah, the low-carb people have called it by a variety of terms. Low-carb flu.
Exactly.
Atkins flu, paleo flu. There's no such counterpart in low-fat diets. There's no such thing as a low-fat flu. I believe it's because the common thread among low-carb diets and all the various labels and forms is stopping grains. And by the way, you can mimic the effect of a withdrawal by administering a drug like Narcan, which, as you and I know, is an opiate-blocking drug. You can mimic the withdrawal process. It's very unpleasant. It lasts about a week. It's nausea, headache, depression, fatigue, sometimes cravings, a lot of crabbiness. So I tell people try to choose a non-stressful period to do this if possible. Hydrate well. Add back salt because you lose a lot of water in this process.
Right.
There's some other tricks you can use to kind of soften the blow. But if you're going to have withdrawal, you're going to have withdrawal, and it can be very unpleasant, but you get through it.
So let's summarize, because what you're saying is that there may be a variety of mechanisms by which wheat and related grains create problems. So let's enumerate them. One is the carbohydrate load that they impart and what that does to the body's insulin. Why don't you tackle that one?
Yeah, so there's a unique, we've been told for years that so-called complex carbohydrates and grains are good for us. They're better for us than simple sugars. Well, that's not true. The amylopectin A, unique to grains, is very highly digestible by the enzyme amylase in saliva and stomach, and it raises blood sugar ounce for ounce higher than table sugar.
Wow.
So, when you think about it, it should come as no wonder at all that we now have a nation of diabetics, the worst epidemic of diabetes ever in the history of man on earth, created by our own USDA and other agencies dispensing dietary advice to eat more healthy whole grains.
And of course, high levels of insulin promote low blood sugar, and then you perpetuate your cravings, and pretty soon you're on a carbohydrate binging roller coaster, constantly stoking your excess insulin with delivering carbohydrates.
Exactly right. So we have these nice dietitians telling people, well, eat many small meals all throughout the day, every 2 hours. Terrible advice. It just feeds into that two-hour cycle of hyper followed by hypoglycemia. So exactly right.
So, that's just one mechanism. Then there is, celiac disease, of course, and we recognize that, and that's a very serious problem because we know that it can cause not just gastrointestinal problems, but it can cause severe autoimmune problems. It can affect the brain. It can affect all the organs of the body. It's terrible. Osteoporosis, very pervasive problems. That's a model for serious autoimmune disease. But you mentioned that there's a sub-threshold autoimmune effect that may not be that may be underestimated when we do intestinal biopsies or when we do the standard blood tests. How about that?
Yeah, well, 200 diseases of autoimmunity have been linked to wheat consumption. So it's not like a short list. It's a long list. It includes rheumatoid arthritis, lupus, polymyalgia rheumatica, type 1 diabetes in children, a multitude of skin diseases, autoimmune hepatitis, autoimmune pancreatitis, gastroparesis, loss of parietal cells that produce stomach acid in the stomach. It's a long, long list. Not to say each and every case of each of those is caused by wheat, but a lot of them are. And how many other causes can we say, well, you can get rid of the cause just by not eating it? I mean, it's an incredibly easy thing. And I've now lost track of the many, many people who are former sufferers of rheumatoid arthritis, lupus, all these other autoimmune inflammatory diseases. So it's a long, long list. What we don't have is a large, large trial in the whole mixture of autoimmune diseases. We do have, by the way, there are good data in rheumatoid arthritis that wheat avoidance enhances remission, enhances chances of remission. So we do have a fair amount of data. That's, by the way, one of the things that really surprised me when I tried to understand what the heck was going on with my patients was, you know what? There's a ton of data already. Not a lot. You have a great command of it, but most of our colleagues do not. And so it didn't put two and two together and step back and say, now, wait a minute here. This seems like an awfully long list of diseases caused by the consumption of wheat. Maybe we shouldn't eat it at all.
Indeed. And going further through this list of potential problems, is there a distinct wheat allergy that may be distinct from wheat autoimmunity, where people have allergic symptoms? Perhaps they have nasal congestion, perhaps they have skin itching, perhaps they have some form of brain fog that is directly related to some sort of IgE-mediated or otherwise immune-mediated allergic intolerance to wheat. That's pretty prevalent too, right?
Absolutely. So all those manipulations performed on wheat and other grains as well changes proteins. It may only change one or two or three amino acids, but that's enough, as you know, to trigger an allergic phenomenon. And so they change the structure of alpha amylase inhibitors, trypsin inhibitors, gamma gliadins, and dozens, perhaps hundreds, of other proteins in wheat and grains. And so now they've been linked with, as you point out, skin rashes of a variety of forms, various forms of gastrointestinal complaints, asthma, and lots of other allergic phenomena. So that alone is a big, big issue.
Well, there's so many patients that I test who are sensitive to grass. They have grass pollen allergies. And so I sometimes ask them, and this is a little bit facetiously, I said, well, you know, you don't eat grass, do you? And they say, of course not, I don't eat grass. Nobody, who eats grass? And I say, well, in fact, you are eating grass. Do you realize? Because if you get down on your lawn and you hold up one of those little tiny blades of grass and you see the little seeds from the grass, it'll look, you know, close up, it looks like a stalk of wheat. Because, in effect, it's related to wheat. And there's a lot of cross-reactivity. So people who have grass allergies, which are very prevalent, they're eating grass. They're ingesting grass, which probably isn't good for their grass allergies.
Absolutely. You know, there's an unbelievable picture, a series of pictures posted on the internet of a charismatic preacher in South Africa who actually persuaded his congregation to go outside in the lawn and eat the grass.
Wow.
And they did. And then there's the next series of pictures. They're all running to the toilet to throw up and have diarrhea.
Not so good. Not so good. Well, the Lord will provide, but in that case, didn't work out too well. I guess Jesus made the loaves, but that preacher, you know, epic fail when he told the patients to eat the lawn. So and another mechanism, and I think this is intriguing because we're seeing more and more of this, and I know that you're a real scholar of this, of all the possible reactions, is what do certain foods do to change our guts? And, you know, the microbiome seems to be very important in terms of immunity. It seems to be important, obviously, in terms of digestion, plays a major role in gastrointestinal disorders, but also just in terms of just our overall health. And when we can, you know, the food that we eat changes the composition of our microbiome. So what changes occur when we alter our diet substantially, get off grains that might be to our benefit?
You know, that needs to be better explored. We know, I agree with you, that the microbiome and the bowel flora composition is a critical issue. As you know, we poo-pooed this, forgive the pun, for many years.
Once you start talking about it, you can't stop, right? It's like
right. But the opposite is proving true, that attention to the bowel flora composition is a critical facet of health. It's clear that when grains are added to a non-grain eater's diet, it changes the bowel flora composition dramatically. That's well established. What's not clear, as you know, is if we stop the awful effects of grains on bowel flora and intestinal health, what constitutes kind of a perfect bowel flora panel? As you know, nobody knows what percentage of, say,
right,
lactobacillus.
We're only beginning to explore this. We're just in the beginnings,
yeah,
of our understanding of it.
I tell you what I do in a practical way, because you and I have only so much time to wait before the Human Microbiome Project publishes all its findings. I ask people that once they stop the grains to initiate a high-potency probiotic, what I regard as seeding the colon with new species, or at least healthier species, that helps kind of out-muscle the unhealthy species. As you know, unhealthy people who consume grains, tend to have less diversity,
right,
and have a proliferation of unhealthy species, and in its worst forms, dysbiosis. So I urge people to start a high-potency probiotic in the range of 30 to 50 billion CFUs a day, and to also cultivate healthy flora, and this will get a little complicated, as you know, by encouraging consumption of a specific class of fibers, prebiotic fibers, some people call them resistant starches, because these fibers are not digestible by humans, but are digestible by bowel flora, and they do wonderful things with them. And if you do this right, you get even further benefits. You get less intestinal permeability that leads to autoimmune diseases. You get better bowel health, regularity, reduction in colon cancer. You get metabolic benefits, reduction of blood sugar, blood pressure, reductions of triglycerides. Really, really great effects, though it takes about 2 or 3 months to develop.
Okay, well, we've laid out the problem, and as our listeners know, we usually divide these podcasts into two parts, so let's stipulate this as part one. When we return with today's guest, Dr. William Davis, who's author of Wheat Belly, and his latest book is Wheat Belly Total Health, where he further elaborates on the consequences of eating grains and how to optimize your health by changing your diet. We will take up the practical aspects of this. What's left to eat? What conditions can this address? What can you expect? What if your weight loss stalls? These are topics that are in the new book, Wheat Belly Total Health, and we'll talk about them in part two of today's podcast with Dr. William Davis. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.